80, Book 4, Uneasy Coexistence, in which a pick-and-choose attitude to the past is used to create modernity by enforcement or by disguising itself in the deceits of nostalgia.
81. The Indian Atomic Energy Commission published a book by Dr. M. R. Srinivasan in which he described, as if an intrepid explorer, his trip looking for a site for India's first nuclear reactor in 1948. Chakravarti and I made a reconnaissance visit to the west coast, from Bombay to the Dahej on the Narmada River, close to where the river joins the sea. Three coastal sites appeared promising, and one of them was Tarapur. Chakravarti and I set off to Tarapur by road. The Bombay-Ahmedabad highway had not yet been built, so we drove from Bombay to Bhiwandi and on to Manohar. From Manohar, we proceeded to Palghar and then on to Tarapur. The Manohar-Palghar stretch across the Western Ghats was deeply furrowed, with the middle hump posing a hazard to the engine crankcase. In fact, our car did hit a high bump and there was an oil leak from the crankcase. We had to have the State Transport Bus Depot at Palghar attend to the problem. It was monsoon time and there had been a lot of rain. From Tarapur, Chakravarti and I got onto a bullock cart, as it was the only way to reach a lighthouse, just north of the coastal promontory, which I had selected as a potential site from the study of the maps. We could go no further than the lighthouse, as there was no cart track even, and the approach was very slushy and waterlogged. From the very first visit, I was convinced that Tarapur offered an ideal site for an atomic power station. Cited in Itti Abraham, The Making of the Indian Atomic Bomb, Science, Secrecy and the Post-Colonial State, 1998. At the same time, the construction of the reactor was being debated in the Constituent Assembly. One member, H.V. Kamat, spoke of how a 2,000-year-old Sanskrit verse described the world of atomic physics. In the infinitesimal, as well as the infinite, in the atom, as well as the universe, resides one Shakti. The analytical methods of science will bring us to the same view as was arrived at by the synthetic process of our sages and seers.
82. At the Great Exhibition held in London in 1851 to show off Britain's place as the world's first and leading industrial country, the best location in the middle of the Great Hall was allocated to the Gothic Revival movement. It was much more than just an art movement. The British elite took delight in disguising their high-tech commercial republic as a medieval monarchy. In the most modern nation in the world, the latest industrial innovation masqueraded as an archaic feudal custom.
83. The Hospital of St. Veronica of the True for colonic and respiratory diseases was described by Thomas Pynchon in his novel Gravity's Rainbow as a Victorian paraphrase of that which once, long ago, resulted in Gothic cathedrals, but which in its own time arose not from any need to climb through the fashioning of suitable confusions towards any apical god, but more in a derangement of aim, and so bent the intentions of the builders not to any zenith, but back to fright, to simple escape in whatever direction from the industrial smoke, street excrement, windowless warrens were saying about the chances of mercy that year.
84. Adolf Loos. Ever since humanity discerned the stature of classical antiquity, one single thought has united all the great architects. They think, I'm building the way the ancient Romans would have done. We know that they are wrong.
85. The pack donkey's way is responsible for the plan of every continental city, which must be destroyed to make way for the city of the future. In contrast to the accidental growth and arbitrary structures of cities in the past, The modern city lives by the straight line, inevitably, for the construction of buildings, sewers, and tunnels demands the straight line. It is the proper thing for the heart of a city. The curve is ruinous, difficult, and dangerous. It is a paralyzing thing. Man walks in a straight line because he has a goal and knows where he is going. He has made up his mind to reach some particular place and goes straight to it. The pack donkey meanders along, meditates a little in his scatterbrained and distracted fashion. He zigzags in order to avoid the larger stones, or to ease the climb, or to gain a little shade. He takes the line of least resistance. But man governs his feelings by his reason. He keeps his feelings and instinct in check, and subordinating them to the aim he has in view. He rules the brute creation by his intelligence. His intelligence formulates laws which are the product of experience. His experience is born of work. Man works in order that he not perish, in order for that production to be possible. A line of conduct is essential. The laws of experience must be obeyed. Man must consider the result in advance. But the pack donkey thinks of nothing at all, except what will save him trouble. Le Corbusier, The City of Tomorrow and Its Planning, 1929.
86. In 1951, the architect was put in charge of the construction of the city of Chandrigarh in Indian Punjab, which had lost its original capital, Lahore, to Pakistan as a result of partition. Here, his attitude experienced an enforced change, as construction would have been impossible without the work of the load-carrying donkey, and it seemed that he might erect a statue of one in recognition of their contribution.
87. Sardar City, Baghdad, was designed by Constantinos Doxiadis, funded in part by the Ford Foundation, as part of the 1958 Master Plan for Baghdad. It was no Orientalist labyrinth, but a modernist, hyper-rationalist grid that had become a vast sprawling slum, an eventful visualisation of a city in motion rather than a static morphology, revealed that anti-USA coalition, anti-government religious rhetoric originated from those areas of Baghdad characterised by low electrical distribution, sewage running raw through the streets, little or no potable water distribution, and no solid waste pickup. In short, areas where local infrastructure was in a shambles became prime recruiting areas for insurgent forces and in turn danger zones for US troops. Derek Gregory, The Rush to the Intimate, 2008.
88. In the social housing constructions of Red Vienna after the First World War, the socialist predilection for courtyards and monumental facades highlighted not only their belief in the social function of architecture, but also a sensitivity to the cultural memory of Habsburg architecture in the Baroque era. In some of the more marginal projects, which diverged from both monumentalism and German functionalism, buildings achieved a more complex balance of tradition and modernity, and a greater diversity of colour and detail. The buildings survive, but when the fascist paramilitary fired on the Karl Marx Hof in February 1934, it was the idea, not the buildings of Red Vienna, they destroyed.
89. Western alliance leaders must play the role of a barbarian chieftain. In theory, international law governs world politics. In practice, relations between great powers are regulated by a sort of code duello, designed to ritualize the struggle for power, not to end it. Such an ancient code of honor may not be Judeo-Christian, yet it is moral just the same. Our moral values, our fear of collateral damage, represent our worst vulnerabilities. The most sincere and heartbreaking truth of the ancients is the vast gulf that separates political military virtue from individual moral perfection. It is such truth that may help to define the 21st century as we are forced to choose in the middle of a high-tech war between right and what is unfortunately necessary, and may have to choose what is unfortunately necessary. The guru of these armchair Spartans, the American militarist Samuel Huntington, now famous for his Clash of Civilizations, claimed in 1968 that the USA had found the antidote to the Maoist threat in Southeast Asia. By destroying the peasantry as a class, they would deprive the Vietnamese revolutionary movement of its social base. Echoing Joseph Stalin, he praised the state violence for its alchemic ability to accelerate the process of modernization.
91. The cultural turn in U.S. military counterinsurgency has directed attention to the normative construction of military operations in ways that have foreclosed questions about their practice. This has been compounded by media coverage of the new mission rehearsal exercises, video games and simulations in which the distinction between the virtual and the real have been consistently blurred. Report after report begins with a vivid description of military operations that is interrupted by variations on the same cut line. Only this isn't Iraq, it's Fort Polk, Fort Irwin, virtual Iraq. The implication is that the hyperrealism of the simulation mimics the conduct of the war. We're in another flat world, moving seamlessly from the virtual to the real, and encouraged to mistake the one for the other. The joint focus on doctrine and training, the normative and the virtual, is an invitation to step through the back of the wardrobe into a martial Narnia, where the American military consistently follows the rules and intervenes for the greater good. Derek Gregory, The Rush to the Intimate, Radical Philosophy, 2008.
92. Stephen Chan, The End of Certainty, 2011. Samurai manuals of correct behavior prescribed not only state loyalty, unquestioning unto death, but the complete aesthetic nature of every fragment of samurai behavior. Curious fusions could be allowed. For instance, tea could be drunk from modern cups, but had to be poured from a pot that was unvarnished and shaped in the old style. That is, the source always had to appear old. In the post-shogunate era, when the emperor was restored, the embrace of technological modernity meant the samurai as military guardians were now useless, but it did not mean their obsolescence. The very fact that with their now codified lore and laws, they could not progress meant they were available as a stable historical image that could be fused to the actuality of modern life, to give the Western apparatus of technology a domestication and cultural license.
93. As Britain has a feudal past, so has India, particularly the India of princes and the great mass of the Indian peasantry. The application of social evolutionary theories to India by a wide range of British officials and scholars yield a crucial ruling paradigm. The Indian present was the European past. This construction of a universal history enabled the British to control the Indian past, as they too had been feudal but had advanced out of this stage. Indians, it was believed, were susceptible to show and drama, and hence more occasions were found where rulers and subject could pay their appointed parts and could act their traditions through costume. Hence the insistence that chiefs and their retinues should appear in their most colorful, if outmoded, clothes. B.S. Cohn, Colonialism and Its Forms of Knowledge, 1996.
94. The history in which caste has been constituted as the principal modality of Indian society draws as much from the role of British Orientalists, administrators and missionaries as it does from Indian reformers and political actors, to produce caste as the measure of all social things. A feat that could not have been accomplished had caste not become one of the most important emblems of tradition, the not-so-obscure object of desire for many Westerners and Indians alike. At the same time, it was a core feature of colonial power knowledge. Colonial knowledge both enabled conquest and was produced by it. In certain important ways, knowledge was what colonialism was all about. Cultural forms in societies newly classified as traditional were reconstructed and transformed by this knowledge, which created new categories and oppositions between coloniser and colonised. Nicholas B. Dirks, Cost of Minds, Colonialism and the Making of Modern India, 2001.
95. We are living on a mountain of corpses and pain, wrote the Austrian novelist Elfriede Jelinek in 1995, quoting the Brothers Grimm fairy tale of the obstinate girl whose hand keeps growing out of the grave and protests against being dead. The power elite are keen to cut the hand off. In Spain, the voices of death, of the civil war demanding to be heard, were in effect censored by the right-wing People's Party government in 2011, when it abolished the Office of Victims of the Civil War and the Dictatorship, which coordinated the exhumation of the remains of those who disappeared.
In the 1993 Brazilian presidential elections, both candidates, Fernando Cardoso and Luiz Inácio da Silva, Lula, visited Canudos in the Pú region of Bahia. At the end of the 19th century, a self-organized Christian socialist community of 3,000 people developed there. It was intolerable to the Brazilian state, and in 1897 it resolved to destroy it, which needed 5 military expeditions until the trenches have been reduced to graves of dust, and still the Canudos community does not surrender. This utopia without property or law, where the poor shared their miserly land, the paltry bread, and faith in the immensity of heaven. They fight house by house, inch by inch. The last 4 survivors fall. 3 men, 1 child. In his stop there, Lula described the community of 100 years before as a religious social revolution. In a restaging of the Last Supper, he distributed bread to the people and declared, "The red of the flag of the Workers' Party is the blood of Jesus on the cross."
97. If I obtain great authority and power, I think I will bring about a coup. Suddenly, in one moment, the desired revolution in our social life. Because unlike others, I don't believe that this deed can be achieved by slowly raising the intelligence of others to the level of my own. My soul rebels against such a course. Why, after my years of education, after studying civilization and the socialization processes, after spending my life and my time to gain pleasure from freedom, should I descend to the level of the common people? I will make them rise to my level. Let me not resemble them. They should resemble me. Kemal Atatürk's first president of post-Ottoman Turkey. President Erdogan of Turkey's presidential palace cost $650 million to build. Inspired by Seljuk architecture of the 11th and 13th century, it has 1,150 rooms, additional guest houses, a botanical garden, a situation room with satellite and military communication system, bunkers able to withstand biological, nuclear and chemical weapons attack, a park and a congress centre. The complex employs high security measures with additional insulation against wiretapping to prevent the planting of bugs, One of the offices in the palace has no electrical outlets.
98. Kemal Atatürk, who, as the father of modern Turkey, outlawed the fez in its name. Men were to wear hats with brims. He himself was not averse to top hats. 18 people were executed in various parts of Turkey for opposing the hat law that became effective in 1925, while many were imprisoned or exiled. Public servants, for whom it was mandatory to wear hats, were given hat advances so that they could buy them. During the days when a hat advance was 80 liras, a loaf of bread cost 5 kouros. That meant 1,600 loaves of bread bought one hat. Ece Temel Kurum, Turkey, the Insane and the Melancholy, 2016. As early as 1871, in Japan, samurai-style topknots were to be cut in favour of Western-style coiffure. A verse of the time claimed, "If you tap a shaven and topknot head, you will hear the sound of retrogression. But if you tap a close-cropped head of hair, you will hear the sound of culture and enlightenment."
99. At the same time, the emperors of Japan wore the thick brown cloth of mulberry fibre instead of the usual fine silk fabrics on occasions of death or investiture, a master symbol of Neolithic ancestral ties, just as the Ashanti rulers of modern-day Ghana donned bark cloth for ancestral rites.
100. Bertolt Brecht, Ancient Times, in his Stories of Mr. Koiner, 2006. In front of a constructivist picture by the painter Lundstrom, depicting some jerks, Mr. K said, "A picture from ancient times, from a barbarous age. In those days, men could probably no longer tell things apart. Round things no longer appeared round, pointed things no longer pointed. The painters had to put things straight again and show their customers something definite, unambiguous, well-defined. They saw so much that was indistinct, fluid, obscure. They were so starved for incorruptibility that they were ready to acclaim a man who wouldn't sell the fool's cap. Work was distributed among many, one can see that from the picture. Those who determined the form did not concern themselves with the purpose of the objects. No water can be poured from this jug. In those days, there must have been many people who were regarded solely as commodities. That too the artists had to resist. A barbarous age, those ancient times." Mr. K's attention was called to the fact that the picture was a contemporary one. "Yes," said Mr. K sadly, "from ancient times."